shortly. I see the full title. So first, we will hear from Dr. Pyeongpyeon Woo, a postdoctoral researcher at Dartmouth College, and Caradwen Foley, a research assistant at Boston University SRP Center, who will discuss an examination of fish consumption advisories. Their work addresses the spatial differences in multi-chemical co-exposures from consuming fish, as well as highlights a need to revisit the approach to establishing fish consumption advisories that reflect exposure to chemical mixtures to address the totality of risks and benefits of fish consumption. Pyeongpyeon and Caradwen, I now turn it over to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. And this is Pyeongpyeon Woo from Dartmouth College, together with my colleague Caradwen Foley from Boston University School of Public Health. We're excited to be here today and have this opportunity to share with you our work about foul fish contaminant data and why we think it matters for improving our fish consumption advisories. So for those of you who are not familiar with FAIR, it is a term that addresses the process of making big data be easily found, is accessible to others, and can be interoperable with other data, enabling optimal reuse of information using persistent identifiers. And we will be sharing our experiences on how we have collected public data and making it fair, then advancing to the part how we have applied this fair data to an important societal problem that incorporates elements of risk assessment of multiple contaminants from an environmental science research point of view. So here a quick overview of our talk today. As researchers in environmental and environmental public health science working with fish tissue contaminants, the ability to use a searchable data platform containing publicly available fish tissue contaminant data is a key to advance our knowledge of the trends in environmental contaminants regionally and nationally. We're keen to understand whether the use of public fish contaminant data sets will support further risk evaluation of combined exposure to multiple contaminants for the development of health protective fish consumption advisories. Now let's start with some background information. So next slide. Regarding some shortcomings in our current public fish contaminant data sets and fish consumption advisories across the nation. So most of the public environmental data have been collected by various schemes over time, covering varying sets of contaminants with different fish species covered from very different water systems. Majority of those data sets address primarily mercury, while concerns over polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs, pesticides, or emerging pollutants like polyfluoroalkyl substances, usually abbreviated as PFAS, are much lagging behind. Regional differences in fish consumption advisories can also be confusing, as shown in the figure on the right. And so this is an example from the recently published paper by our colleagues in Middlebury University, showing that we have different consumption guidelines issued by states bordering Lake Michigan for 20-inch long lake trout. So same species and also same fish sizes. The different fish consumption guidance is solely depending on which side of the shore the fishes have been caught, without considering that the fish might be migrating from one side to another. So next slide. And regarding the fish consumption advisories across the nation in fresh waters, a little less than 45% of the national lake acres had fish consumption advisories covered until 2011, while almost all of those focused on mercury in fish. And this also increased significantly over time until 2011. Much fewer advisories are for PCBs and pesticides. The advisories are dependent on having fish tissue data, and those data need to show elevated concentrations of contaminants. We cannot know whether the other water bodies lack the advisories because of lack of data or whether the fish tissue is relatively contaminated. And as for the fish consumption advisories based on local monitoring data, the cost of carrying out analysis of organic pollutants are much higher compared with mercury analysis. So for example, just a few dollars, so you can carry out a fish mercury analysis, but it would take several hundreds more for PCB analysis and could be up to 1,000 for dioxin analysis. And these are contaminants that's much more toxic compared to mercury. And this might explain why we have much less advisories for PCBs and pesticides and even less for dioxins up until 2011, given inadequate monitoring results. There were no PFAS advisories existed in 2011, along a few states have begun to establish them in recent years, for example, in New York. Another discrepancy we've noticed is that some states have more expensive advisories that cover more chemicals groups. For example, there are more in Massachusetts than those have been established in Nevada. In cases where there are Superfunds or state hazardous waste sites, there are fish consumption advisories and a designated stretch of a river, a harbor, or a small surface of water bodies. So for example, parts of the New Bedford Harbor have a complete fishing ban, while adjacent regions have fish consumption advisories. Now I would like to hand over to my colleague, Catwin, to address why we think having fair fish contaminant environmental data is important, how and what we have done to address the issue.
All right, thank you. Next slide, please. Great. So this project is significant in that it pulls together existing data sets to allow us to address some of the limitations to the traditional risk assessment paradigm that's used to develop fish consumption advisories. And specifically, we want to be able to get a more comprehensive picture of the risk that people might actually be bearing in some of these geographies that are affected by multiple contaminants. And we also think there's a real opportunity here to offer communities more visibility into those risks and to engage their own knowledge to map out their exposures, including multiple exposures, in the context of a risk-benefit assessment that really considers the whole picture. So one that includes the health benefits of consuming fish relative to other protein sources and the cultural importance of both fish consumption and of ecological preservation, for instance, in native communities where fishing and fish consumption play a huge role in cultural heritage. And in public health, we want to examine issues through a One Health perspective, where we're keeping in mind that promoting public health requires us also to maintain a healthy ecosystem, protecting non-human species, and really to recognize the interconnectedness between our well-being and the well-being of the broader environment. We don't envision fish consumption advisories as the end game in and of themselves. Their purpose is to protect public health. So they should be driving decision-making with respect to the cleanup of hazardous waste in the environment. They should be informing source reduction regulations. And fundamentally, we should use them as tools to address societal needs that aren't met by our current approaches to risk-based consumption advisories. So this is a pretty ambitious set of objectives. And the piece of it that we're tackling first is putting together a data repository that we hope will allow us to look at some of these questions a bit more comprehensively than we've been able to date. Next slide, please. So to develop this data repository, we've sourced data from a few different national and regional monitoring programs. The National Rivers and Streams Assessment and the National Lake Fish Tissue Study are the two EPA data sets that we've ingested so far. And we've also pulled in data from the Great Lakes Fish Management and Surveillance Program. Between them, these data sets cover measurements taken from 1999 to 2018, and they encompass measurements of different tissue matrices for several different freshwater fish species. We have data for mercury and for a broad array of organic contaminants as well. Next slide, please. So a little bit about the repository itself. It's a relational database built in PostgreSQL that integrates these sort of disparate original data sets. And our collaborators in the Advanced Computing Lab at Dartmouth helped design the data schema that would allow us to map in each of these different data sets. They created mappings for each of the fields in each data set. They harmonized the data types and the lengths, and they ensured that we had consistent identifiers for all of the source data sets. And sitting on top of this database, we've also built a mapping tool that we can use to examine this nationwide data geospatially. The database and the mapping tool were built open source, so all of our ETL code lives in GitHub, so it's accessible not just for our own existing mapping tool, but also for other cloud-based applications that that communities and other organizations and bodies might find useful. So we're really excited about the implications for having these data sets more integrated and more accessible. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick snapshot of what the online interface looks like. And this sample is actually National Coastal Condition Assessment data. So these aren't included in the freshwater fish analyses that we're gonna cover today. But it's a good just little kind of example of how the data looks now that it's been cleaned and imported. So we've got identifiers that attribute all of the data sources. We've got date stamps for the sample collections. We have species designations. And we had to do a lot of legwork to figure out how we were going to describe individual chemical species. And this was really challenging, especially for PCBs, where we've got some data sources using numbered PCB nomenclature. As you can see that second line, we've got PCB 180 listed there. And then you've got, you know, heptachlorobisphenol as a separate descriptor. We also had other sources using Arachlor's nomenclature, et cetera. So there were some real challenges to kind of integrate those. We've also got CAS numbers for chemicals wherever available. And of course, one of the nice features of using this database where we're following really systematic procedures to ingest the data is that all of our steps are retraceable. So to get back to those FAIR principles that Pyeongchun was discussing at the start, it's not just that we've designed a system here that's reusable and reproducible by others, but it also enables internal reusability that we can use for QA and QC purposes. Next slide, please. So I've already started telling you about some of the challenges that we encountered, and those issues with chemical nomenclature were really just the beginning. But fundamentally, there was no uniform ontology for harmonizing disparate fish tissue data sources. We did have some of these existing ontologies for certain sets of parameters that we drew on, so that we didn't have to totally reinvent the wheel. But to our knowledge, we were integrating those ontologies in a novel way. So we'd have data sets measuring different contaminants, but we might also have data sets using different analytical methods over time with different reporting limits. Some data sources would be communicating fillet versus whole fish measurements. Some might report lipid fractions and some might not. So we had this interdisciplinary team working together so that we could tackle these questions that in the short term were just questions about our database architecture and how do we get from point A to point B with you know, the steps of importing these data sets. But broadly, we needed to approach those data architecture questions in a way that was informed by relevant principles from toxicology, from aquatic ecology, from environmental fate and transport, et cetera. And so we were able to share some of that process at the SRP annual meeting in December. The title of the poster is listed on this slide. So here I'm going to hand it back over to Pyeongchun for a bit, and she's going to talk a little bit about some of our analytical findings to date.
Thank you, Catherine, for explaining the data platform development process. And now I will share with you a few examples of how we have applied the FAIR data to help understand combined exposure of multiple contaminants in fish at different scales. We start off with the public data generated by the Great Lakes Fish Management and Surveillance Program. Two fish species of lake trout and walleye were collected on a regular basis in the Great Lakes region since 1970s. An analysis of multiple fish contaminants in pooled fish fillet samples from small numbers of fish that of similar sizes were done. So contaminants analyzed including mercury PCBs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers or PBDE, pesticides that includes deodorants, clodines, and DDTs. So eventually we could identify the analytical results of these multiple contaminants for the fish samples collected from 1999 to 2018. And levels of all contaminants in fish increased with their sizes, as you can see from the figure, hereby the fish length. that's measured in the field. In other words, smaller the fish, smaller the contribution to people's health risk per kilogram of fish consumption. So the human risk, human health risk-based screening values, or RSVs, for allowable consumption of fish is highlighted in the corresponding colored horizontal lines in the figure. And with fish PCBs on RSVs of merely 0.12 ppb, so that's the one located at the bottom line, and addressing the safe limit of total PCBs in fish. And this is a much lower value compared to other contaminants. For example, we have mercury RSVs at 300 ppb, PBD at 210, chlordane and DDT close to 70, PFAS at 40, and deodorant at 1.5. So all these are units in ppb or microgram per kilogram by wet weight measurement. So it looks, see if I can change to the next slide. Okay, now this works. So it looks worrisome that most fish PCBs exceeded the human risk, human health risk-based screening values in the Great Lakes region. However, if we looked at the changes of multiple contaminants over time, it is easier to notice that the fish PCBs have actually been decreasing significantly year after year, indicating remarkable work has been carried out in tackling the PCB contamination in recent decades. But on the other hand, the changes of other contaminants, including mercury pesticides, are more stable, or marginal changes of decreasing. So these are also less significant when comparing with the changes in PCBs. While we are hearing more and more discussions over PFAS and contamination in water these days, it is of no doubt that when PFAS is included in a sampling regime, so it is often detected in fish tissue nowadays. So the PFAS analysis was added into the Great Lakes Environmental Monitoring and Surveillance Program starting from 2011, while regulations are being developed regularly. So the short temporal trends of the PFAS in lake trout from the Great Lakes region, as you can see from this small figure, is that there was a significant increase of the PFAS until 2015 and then stabilized until 2018. And until 2018, some of the fish PFAS is still above the regional screening values. And given that the PFAS is listed in the emerging chemicals group, so more extensive monitoring work of this chemical needs to be done for the further risk evaluation. Now we zoom out to look into the pattern of multiple contaminants in freshwater fish on national scale. And we process the field data derived from fish contaminants data as from the National Rivers and Stream Assessment Program for fish collected during 2008 and 2009. Mercury, selenium, PCBs, and pesticides are included in a correlation analysis in the figures on this slide. And so the colored circle dots in the correlation graph represent significant correlations and at alpha levels equals 2.08. 0.05, excuse me. Bigger the size of circle dots, higher the size of correlation coefficient. And blue circle dots represent positive correlations, and the red ones represent negative. And also darker the color means that this correlation is stronger. So to the left, we have the correlation of multiple contaminants in fish from non-urban sites. You can notice that the fish mercury is negatively correlated with the pesticides of cis-non alcohol and deodorant, where most of the organic contaminants, including pesticides, PBDs, and PCB congeners, they very much correlate positive with each other. And to the right, we have the correlation of multiple contaminants in fish collected from urban sites, where population density exceeds 50,000 people, as opposed to the non-urban site. Fish mercury is not only negatively correlated with the cis non chlor and deodorant, so this type of pesticides, but also it is negatively correlated with selenium, total chlordane, and a PCB congener. So a short note about selenium is that it is an important detoxifying substance. So more significant and positive correlations among the organic contaminants of PCB congeners, PBDs, and pesticides can be noticed instantly from this figure to the right, because obviously we have a much deeper color pattern in the middle of the correlation graphs. We have also looked into the geographical pattern of freshwater fish from lakes by using the environmental monitoring data from National Study of Chemical Residues in Lake Fish Tissue Program, which runs from 1999 to 2003 and targeted more than 200 different persistent bioaccumulative toxic chemicals, including mercury, PCBs, PBDs, and pesticides in freshwater lake fish species. So the graph demonstrates the coverage of sampled fish across the nation along the fish mercury levels in color gradient. So darker the color and higher the fish mercury levels. So for example, red and blue dots are for mercury's above 100 ppb. And then lighter the color, that means lower the mercury concentration. So orange and yellow ones would typically means it's below 100 ppb. And we chose one of the most common fish species listed in this data set, largemouth bass, to carry out correlation analysis. Some of the most frequently coexisting persistent bioaccumulative and toxic chemicals in fish, including mercury, DDT compounds, and PCB congeners, are displayed in the correlation graphs across three different regions, from left to right, California, Midwest, and New England. So again, we have color circle dots in the correlation grids represent significant correlation at alpha equals to 0.05. So bigger the sizes of circle dots in the grid, higher the correlation coefficient. And blue dots represent positive correlations. So one straightforward message we can see is that California is the only region among the three focused regions that is showing strong positive correlations of fish mercury with PCBs in largemouth bass, opposing to the correlation patterns in the other two regions. But still, there is much work to be done based on the processed FAIR data derived from public environmental monitoring data sets. Yet, we're able to address some extent of the combined exposure of multiple contaminants from regional to national scale. Now I'll hand over to Kat Wen again to draw a conclusion of our work.
Thank you. Okay, so some of the opportunities that we're really excited about here. First off, from a data access standpoint, we're really bringing data together into this repository that haven't been collated before. So this is a great opportunity, not just for SRPs to be able to consult multiple data sources without having to merge them all together all over again, but we think also for government authorities and for independent researchers and citizen scientists. We think this is a really powerful example of a way to enable communities to use, in some cases, what starts off as small data pulled together in a way that makes it possible to make meaning and to start to understand risk in a new way. As Pian-Pian was saying at the beginning of this talk, the existing approach to fish advisories does not account for the co-occurrence of multiple contaminants and the risks associated with multiple exposures. So we think that tools like this repository could be a way to give communities and residents greater transparency and access to information to enable risk decision-making that's based on more comprehensive information. We'd also like to explore opportunities for collaboration in data collection. First off, it would be great to propagate some, you know, broadly held norms around what a data set that describes fish tissue contamination should contain and how those data should be described. But we can also envision in the future potentially enabling other researchers to submit data to this repository to have it go through these systematized cleaning and QC processes so that we can collaborate more effectively and be able to draw on this kind of shared, robust data source. Next slide, please. So in terms of what's next, you know, it's almost a punchline at this point that researchers always say that additional research is needed. And while that's true, we also think that this work provides a really important framework for research translation and how the data can be used to inform and engage communities in understanding their risk. EPA and USGS have done really fantastic work in fish monitoring to date, but we like to see broader and more systematic data collection efforts so that we're really getting comprehensive information about what is contaminating fish across the country. And that should contain detailed ecological variables and detailed contaminant information, and also highly specific information. So in order for that to happen, you know, to continue the kinds of interdisciplinary work that we've been doing to build this repository, capacity building and funding are going to be really critical, both for initial data collection and collation, and as well for the analysis and communications pieces, and for, you know, those are really necessary for improving the health of populations that depend on fish for their well-being. So we think conveners like NIEHS have a really important role to play here, and that collaboration is going to be essential to push work like this forward. So we're really excited to continue this project and see where it goes. So on the next slide, we note our specific grants. We really appreciate the support of the Superfund Research and Training Program. And we want to thank you so much for your time. We're more than happy to take questions. And our contact information is also on the final slide as well, if there's anything that that comes to mind after this talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pianpian and Caradwen, for that presentation. Everyone in the audience, remember, you may submit questions using the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right corner. And if you're on the phone, you can raise your hand by pressing *9 on the phone. I do see some questions that have come in, so I'm going to start with those. And these came in relatively early in the talk, so even if you maybe got to it a little further in the talk, it would be great to just remind the audience. So the first question is, if you're taking publicly available data, what transformation or modification are you doing to it?
Sure. Some of the most substantial transformations that we had to do were really in terms of achieving greater consistency in how some of the same things were described across data sets. So one of the examples I gave earlier was specific chemical nomenclature. That was a real challenge to kind of pull together, making sure that we had, in some cases, these were things as generic and kind of tactical as ensuring that we had cast numbers sourced for different chemicals. Sometimes it was really more required a little bit more kind of contextual or qualitative interdisciplinary discussion and decision making. So in terms of thinking about like the specificity with which fish species were being described and tagged and what information we had available about their trophic levels or their specific habitats or things like that. So it was oftentimes a question of figuring out, you know, was there information in the metadata for these original data sets that we really needed to be able to have, you know, brought into the repository in a way that was going to be accessible and in a way that was going to allow us to make those multiple data sets interoperable with each other. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Moving on to the next question. Given the spatial viewing options of your data set, are you offering time filters as well?
That's a great question. We do have date stamp data available for when the samples were collected. We haven't built that into our mapping tool yet, but I think that will be really crucial and certainly something that would be accessible to anybody who was, you know, who was consulting this data repository, because all of that information is included. But in terms of building structures on top of it, like the mapping tool, I think those temporal patterns are really important to be able to see, because of, you know, and Pianpian, feel free to layer into this as well. But as our analyses show, those time trends are really striking in some places in terms of how the contaminant features of a given geography change over time. Pian-Pian, is there anything that you
Yes,
want to
I
ask
think
about?
this is an excellent question. So also, we were actually facing this as one of the challenges when processing this data at the different time periods. So apparently, we have regional and national data sets because of the funding differences. So they were also carried out at different time periods. So we have considered that to do a time and trend analysis for some of the bigger national data sets. It is still under consideration, and we've been asking questions from time to time to the EPA people. When we'll be getting the most recently updated national data. So the thing is that this contaminant data at such a big scale, it takes time for the scientists to work on the site and also collect the data and then make it publicized to a greater audience. So it really is a lot of effort. So we are dealing with what we have at the moment, and at this stage, really focusing more from the geospatial point of view. And this is also, but then at the same time, considering the temporal trends, so this is the reason why we have pulled out this brief trend analysis of the fish contaminant data in the Great Lakes region, which we think gives a great overview how specific contaminant changes over time, especially for the PCB. So this is exciting discovery for us. That means that the restrictions really worked, and people are not acknowledging the importance of the fish contaminants.
Yeah, I think one really important consideration for any of these temporal analyses too is under what conditions are data comparable. Even if we have, let's say, data for the same species in a in a specific geography covering consistent contaminants over time, what contextual information do we need to know about the analytical methods used, for instance, to understand, well, are we were these things that would have been non-detect 15 years ago that now we're detecting at lower levels? And
That is
how
a
does that inform?
great segue to the next question. I don't know if you
Right.
saw this paired one, but
No.
the very next question is getting at that topic. So maybe if you could keep going, how does the change in detection limit of a different contaminant over time affect the trends in contaminant levels over time? Are non-detects or low levels affecting the values enough to have their concentrations affecting the measured concentrations enough to affect trends?
That's a fantastic question. the way we try to approach the non-detect issue by using sort of standard imputation techniques where available. So imputing half the detection limit for areas where we have or data points where we have non-detects. But that's a kind of, it's kind of a blunt instrument, and there isn't a particularly, I wish I could answer that question. I think a lot of people in the field would be very grateful if there were an easy answer for that question. But it's certainly a consideration as we've been dealing with this temporal data, where we know that some of those technologies are, those analytical methods are different, and detection capabilities are improving. So how do we ensure that we're sort of situating any temporal analyses we do in such a way that we're giving adequate context about what some of those changes are. And that's something that also is important to us to make sure that we're describing in the data set as needed. What were the detection limits at different points in time so that when we try to go back and do those imputations, we're using appropriate thresholds given the techniques that were available.
Yeah, I think I can add a bit more information and hear about the detection limits. So this is one of the most discussed the issue when we're working on how to handle the data across different data sets because they really varies from time to time and also differs from one data set to another. So to be honest, we had to like writing in a specific request to the data publisher to verify. So what is the method detection limit for specific compounds so that we have an idea how we're going to treat the blanks and et cetera. So all of the preliminary analysis we presented today are actually based on detected values. We have yet to make further inclusion of those of those contaminants that's detected below the detection limit. So we're still discussing a way to get through it. But then for what we have discussed and and show today in the correlation analysis. So I'm showing this one here, as you can see here, that the chemicals that we have chosen to do the correlation analysis. So more than half of them. So most of them had the concentrations, the values being detected over the detection limit, and we believe this is sufficient, like, to make the correlation analysis. And so this is for the National Rivers and Streams Assessment, and also the same we have for the lake fish tissue national data set. So,
if you have more, we do have time. Luckily, there is adequate time built in for questions. So I'm not sure if you want to return to that one. We do have a couple more questions here. I think I'm going to keep going down the line. And the next one is, how did you combine ENVO and CHEBI, or the CHEBI, those ontologies or vocabularies, given that they have a number of overlapping terms?
You know, I would have to go back to our advanced computing lab team to ask for specifics about that. But if the questioner wants to send us an email about that, we'd be more than happy to pull out some specifics and get back in touch.
Okay. Yes, send in more ontology questions.
We yes, please. We're happy to answer them, but we might need to call in help.
Okay, next, from a toxicological perspective, how did you group different chemicals? Toxicological similarities and or dissimilarities, similar modes of action, how did it influence your spatiotemporal aspects exposure? So grouping different chemicals and implications.
Yeah, well, so far, and Pian Pian, also feel free to layer into this, we've only used the kind of groupings very broadly to describe some of the findings. The analyses themselves are all conducted at the individual contaminant level. So we've, you know, used kind of broad descriptors like PCB, or in some cases, I think Pian Pian has started looking at the dioxin-like PCBs, and so kind of predetermined set of shared substances with shared toxicological characteristics and similar sort of modes of action and environmental fate and transport considerations and things like that. But to date, and Pian Pian, correct me if I'm wrong about this, I don't think we've done any analyses that have sort of sought to group the pesticides or the flame retardants or anything like that. The analyses have been more conducted individually, and then as we kind of consult, you know, as we sort of interpret them, as we're drawing conclusions, we want to be able to understand, like, okay, well, how do, PFAS substances and PCBs correlate with one another or with mercury, for instance? So those broad designations are more kind of from an interpretive side than from an analytical side. Can you have anything to add there?
This part. So, and a grouping of chemicals, it was startling to start from the beginning, because I was not really dealing with organic contaminants from the very beginning, and more solely a mercury bioaccumulation research perspective. And so given that there are hundreds of different chemicals, and And it would be too ambitious, like to really like mapping out how every single chemicals or PCB conjugate is been changing over time or differs from region to region. So we used already existing chemical groups that's either summarized in the data set summaries. So this groupings we have now presented in today, we have used the groupings mostly referencing to the National Lake Fish Tissue Study that's addressing mainly the PCBs and a group of PBDs and certain types of the pesticides, the clothing and deodorants and DDT, which we think is the most public concerned chemicals.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I see there are two more questions. I'm not sure if you want to hear them and try to get to them in the next couple of minutes, and hopefully we'll have time at the end to circle back to some of these things. But let me just read quickly. I was somewhat surprised to see that fish mercury levels have remained stable based on your preliminary mixtures analysis given the MATS final rule. Have you considered conducting a nationwide data analysis of fish mercury concentrations starting with the baseline in 2011 until present?
So I can take this question. It is a very important question indeed. So across the world, we have seen that fish mercury has been decreasing in many regions. So what we have shown today is merely based on the data collected from the Great Lakes region. And we said that this is a relatively stable trend. It is, statistically speaking, it is decreasing significantly, but then what we meant that it is stable is that comparing to the PCB trend, this is not really obvious or not as what we have expected after we've paid so much effort in reducing the mercury emissions and cut down the waste size, etc. So we, of course, have been considering doing the national trend, temporal trend analysis, but we are somewhat limited by the current public data resources. So as we have introduced in the presentation that we have several national data sets for freshwaters, either the lake or the river data sets, they were carried out in about a decade or two decades ago. And the most recent national rivers and stream data set won't be available. So until probably later this year or next year, because it really takes a lot of time for the EPA people to compile the data. And as far as I know, there is no really consistent national effort monitoring freshwater fish throughout the time. And there is also an interesting peak of the monitoring data. We have noticed that there is a lot more fish mercury data around 2000, late 1990s and to the beginning of 2000. And then for unknown reason, all of a sudden, things quiet down and we have less mercury monitoring results these days. So again, we're calling out for more attention and also fundings to support consistent monitoring efforts. It takes time. It requires a lot of money.
Thank you so much for the discussion. We still have a few questions and I've made note of those, so hopefully we can circle back, but it looks like you've generated a lot of great questions and conversation. And thank you very much, Pian Pian and Per Duan. We are going to transition now to our second presentation. And Andrew, I see you have your camera on and you're unmuted and you're working on your slides.
Hopefully,
okay.
Them.
We will next hear from Andrew Creamer. Andrew is a research data management librarian at Brown University. He serves in the university library's academic engagement unit as the departmental librarian for the computer science and cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences departments. Andrew will describe opportunities for partnering with libraries for supporting public access to research data and data reuse. Andrew, turning it over to you.
Great, thank you so much. And this is probably a bit of a detour because I'm not an environmental scientist. I'm sort of an informationist scientist. And today's talk is about the role that librarians have played in the external use cases funded by the NIHS focused on FAIR and data reuse. And I'd like to thank the PI of the of Brown's Superfund research program, Professor Hurt, who has been welcome to collaborating with the university library within the Superfund research program. And then also thank all the PIs of the project from the community engagement cores at Texas AMU, UC San Diego, and Professor Frickle, the PI of the community engagement core at Brown, for also being willing to have librarians serve on their research team. And you're probably wondering what an informationist is and who an informationist is. And I will sort of hopefully demystify that. But I'd also like to take a moment to thank Professor Keith Pozzoli at UCSD, who sort of suggested today's talk in that when we looked at across the external use cases being presented, that there were so many librarians and information specialists sort of in the background who were, you know, uncoordinated amongst all the data cores and the CE cores working with these research teams. And he sort of suggested this would be sort of a great way for us to become, and our work to become visible, and then also sort of make hopefully the pitch today that after hearing this talk, you might look towards your academic or public library to find ways that you might be able to engage with the information science community to enhance the fairness, if you will, of your research projects and dissemination of research products. So these are the other PIs, Galen, Jennifer, and Ilya. And I'd also want to credit the trainees who have moved on, Matthew Malecha at Texas A&M, who's now at NIST, and Tom Marlowe, who is now a postdoctoral researcher at NYU, who did so much work for this program, but now have moved on from trainee to their next stage of their careers. So let's start with the jargon of informationist. So this term sort of derives back from this 2000 paper that was focused more on clinical librarians and their role sort of at the bedside, providing information for health practitioners, and was sort of focused on a librarian plus this other disciplinary knowledge. So in this context, it was clinical knowledge, you know, having a librarian that also had expertise in clinical research. And then sort of that embedded model at the sort of the clinical perspective sort of expanded where you might have librarians with other domain or disciplinary knowledge or skill sets being embedded, if you will, into research teams. And we also have the NIH to thank for that sort of incentivizing project that under from 2012 to 2017, where the National Library of Medicine and NIH partnered to provide administrative supplements to R01 grants to partner and or have or collaborate with or add a librarian as a research informationist to an existing R01 award. And so my colleague Erica Savitson and Hope Lappin, who's now at NYU, and I were, we've sort of started off as research informationists through this program. And luckily other institutes within National Institutes of Health have sort of adopted supplements in which librarians have been welcome as research informationists on this project. And we definitely hope it can continue fund some of the projects like the external use case focused on reuse and FAIR data. So this is some of the, you know, as I went through some of my colleagues who, not just on this project for myself, but also at even within the state, Harrison Decker, who's a research informationist at the University of Rhode Island, or Brian Westra at the University of Iowa, that we have all these great colleagues who were participating on the research team doing these types of work. So we focus a lot in research data management on documentation of data so that it's usable by the team, but then usable when you share the data sets, as we've heard in the previous presentation. And so some of those are focused on locating or developing metadata standards in some cases, or as in the case with the external use case, developing a metadata application profile, which I tend to look at as sort of a minimal information standard for the information that you're going to capture in a catalog record that's associated with a data set that's made available to other researchers and the public. And then you see a lot of things that libraries have been doing. So it kind of makes a logical partner for working with controlled vocabularies. So for example, with historical industrial data that Professor Frickle works with at Brown, you know, there's North American industrial codes, so that, you know, if folks are generating data sets based off historical industrial data, that they're referring to these industries using the exact same terms. Some of the ontologies like INVO or CHEVI that was just mentioned in the previous talk, or MeSH or other hierarchies in which we have subject headings or classifications that will help sort of normalize or synchronize among data sets. And then also the types of identifiers associated with not only those vocabularies and ontologies where you have URIs referencing that body or vocabulary or ontology, but then all of these other persistent identifiers that we are keen on and trying to promote within the library, such as digital object identifiers or DOIs for data sets or ARCs, IDs, or ORCIDs, where you have persistent identifiers for researchers themselves. And we might have new persistent identifiers emerge, such as RRIDs, that some folks might be familiar with, where they're persistent identifiers for research materials that are referenced within a method section or a protocol. And it could be research software, it could be a cell line, what have you. Then another sort of area that the library is interested in is authority control. So within these metadata records, are we referencing, if it's GIS coordinates, what system is being referenced? What ISO standard, for example? If there are other types of authorities, if it's geo names, for example, for a city or a state or other geographic entity, we sort of have to sort of connect those to some authority so that folks know what system is being referenced. And then things like provenance, so where has data come from? So I think especially with historical data sets and their involvement in geographic information, I think that's something that the library cares deeply about, is trying to track where have these data sets come from, versioning those data sets, and then understanding the rights associated with those data sets and permissions and how they can be reused or repurposed. And then, the typical research data management role that I would do in my sort of day-to-day role, which is, looking at formats to make sure that the research team's research products are open in a way that other folks can reuse them, or heavily documented, that so even if they're not in a format that can be open, that there's a lot of documentation for folks to be able to locate a copy of that software. And then with dissemination and attribution and archiving, working with the repositories or developing our repositories like our previous talk already covered. And then with reproducibility, there's a growing interest among libraries in sort of differentiating where, some folks have reproducibility, but they don't sort of differentiate among all of these very distinct forms of rigor and transparency that enhance reuse or repurposing. So that might be, for example, with the external use cases, trying to test how replicable are some of our projects, how reusable are some of our data sets, and not just to replicate methods to come up with similar results, but to also take those projects and then create some sort of transformative work, such as in the EUC I'll be talking about, external use case between Texas and UCSD and Brown, and repurposing that data for a new or novel research question. And I was also very happy to hear from Dartmouth, because I feel like among the librarians on the EUCs, we were listening to some presentations in which everyone said, we replicated this and we reproduced this and everything went really swimmingly. and there were no issues. And the reality is that, as we've seen, there are challenges, and data reuse is actually very challenging. And it's sometimes we learn a lot from what has went well, but we also learn so much more if people actually talk about, you know, what didn't work. You know, people want to publish the positive, and there's so much value in if we could publish the things that didn't work so well. And so I'm going to transition to my next slide. And sort of, you know, when we think of FAIR as sort of this abstract, you know, acronym, and sort of putting that into, you know, just taking some words from Wilkinson et al., that the 2016 FAIR paper, and looking at, you know, metadata and data are referenced. And there's a focus on machine readable and machine actionable. So it's not just necessarily human semantic, but making these data sets reusable. So in the case of historical industrial data that Professor Frickel concentrates on creating at Brown, and since it was going to be a data layer in the external use case for looking at toxic transfer and its impact on green infrastructure, there was this idea that we would sort of test the existing protocol and the software to generate the historical data, and then come up with a metadata application profile that sort of incorporated FAIR, so that as other data sets were replicated for Harris County in Texas or in San Diego County in California, that there would be sort of a consistent minimal information standard for the type of FAIR metadata associated with those data sets. And so in this case, you can see the ORCID identifiers for the researchers. You have a data standard, schema.org referenced. And so that idea of the metadata standard being, you know, being able to point back to the URI, back to the standard itself, which is an important feature of FAIR that folks sometimes forget, that it's not just necessarily using the standard, but it's also referencing that standard, or the types of controlled vocabulary ontologies that are used, and the URI is associated with those, and then also that provenance information. So in this case, if it's you know, extracting geocoded information from an historical industrial index from the 19th or early 20th century, we'd want to make sure that we keep that provenance of, you know, what in historical and industrial index is actually being used, so that folks can go back and then maybe cross-reference that information. And so in this case, this was a data set that was extracted from images that were collected by Dr. Zaslavsky, the data scientist at UCSD, and one of the PIs as well, who's, I'm going to sort of get to some of the amazing systems that he has developed for data analysis and visualization, along with one from Texas A&M. And then the machine readable side, you know, we take that same information, but what does a machine see in terms of schema.org? So that's machine actionable and readable from systems like developed at UCSD, like the Data Discovery Studio. And then the third role is sort of helping the team itself. So sort of put some of these principles into practice. So there's a great book by Dr. Kristen Briney, who's at, used to be at Wisconsin, and now she's at Berkeley, I believe, and or Caltech. And she has a book, Research Data Management for Researchers. So it's not aimed at the librarian community, but research community. And I just sort of extracted some of these best practices that we try to incorporate within, you know, the trainees and the SRP that might be associated with, you know, practicing what we're saying, walking the walk. You know, if it's you know, file naming conventions that use an ISO standard for writing the date, making sure that data is backed up and making sure that data formats are open for reuse and repurposing, and then sort of following through with making sure that documentation and data are shared in a repository and cited with within publications, so that other researchers and the public can go back. And then data that's sort of appraised and selected as having long-term value or needing to be retained because of a records retention schedule can be preserved, so that there's preservation of the integrity of the files and then preservation of access. And that takes me sort of closer to the next sort of pitch that I think what excited me about this particular external use case and the growing interest among librarians in environmental research is this concept of collections as data. So I first heard this term in, from Dr. Amanda Whitmire, who's the head of the Hopkins Marine Station, so the Stanford Library located within that at Monterey Bay, who within her library has sort of 100 years worth of reports on biodiversity and oceanographic data. And as a marine scientist and a library professional, she saw the value in sort of applying data science techniques to sort of extract data sets that could then be shared and used, that talks about the, you know, the changes to the marine environment over time. And this collections as data reference comes from this project that was led by Thomas Padilla, called Always Already Computational, an IMLS funded project. And you can see their statement that's on GitHub sort of mirrors a lot of the FAIR language, so that there's this idea that it's not just the data, but it's also the metadata. So data as well as the data that describe those data are considered in scope, that there's certain collections within the library that in the same case as Dr. Whitmire, where we know that within our collections are valuable data sets that would create a data layer that could inform things like toxic transfer and its impact in different spaces. So where the historical industrial data is one example of that, there is probably ones that, you know, as I'm talking, some folks in the and out there virtually, you know, who are environmental scientists might think of things like historical ecology, where there have been, you know, historical maps that have been scanned and geocoded to look at coastal erosion, you know, diaries of folks that mention when plants are in bloom, inventories of fish stocks, for example, herbaria, and including industrial directories that could be used. So this is just an example of a collection we have in the Brown Digital Repository. That's our herbarium that has information about, you know, geographic information about where these specimens were collected and when they were collected. And again, sort of the FAIR application is using things like Darwin Core, a reference standard up at the top for this type of information, phylogenetic information that then folks can use for a research project. And we do have our Data Science Institute working on a project right now involving the herbarium specimens. So with the toxic transfer to green infrastructure, the hope at the beginning was to have that sort of historical layer be one of the data layers for that particular toxic pi score. And so the protocol for that was published by Professor Frickel in this book, Sites Unseen. And it had even from the beginning been a library collaboration, because the Providence Public Library, my colleague, the archivist there, Kate Wells, had been involved in tracking down these historical industrial directories so that they could then be scanned by the Internet Archive, the nonprofit in San Francisco that has a scanning station set up at Boston Public Library. So she, you know, helped us find all of these directories. And then a team within our Center for Computation and Visualization worked with Professor Frickel and the trainee Tom Marlowe to develop software that was used, for example, in the where Dr. Sedlowski extracted that data from those images of directories in San Francisco. And so the sort of use case here was, you know, how replicable is that protocol? How replicable is using that software to generate that layer that can then be reused in that project? So that's just one aspect. And I also want to note that there's this wonderful sort of collaboration of librarians called the Data Curation Network, that I believe is also IMLS funded, that has sort of primers, so geodatabase primers, for example, for making some of these data sets available. And then have all those data sets put into we have a specific digital archive for the Brown Superfund research program to catch some of these long tail data sets that don't necessarily have a designated home within NCBI, for example, that might be focused on genetic information, or proteomic information, but might not necessarily have GIS information that could be lost, or software. So then taking that layer, of course, so this is just my own neighborhood, I happened to, you know, move during the pandemic to a place where, you know, I looked to see Professor Frickle's data set to see, okay, what's in my backyard? And there's a lot in my backyard. So I'll probably be, you know, growing vegetables in a raised bed. You know, Rhode Island has a very industrial past. You can just see from my tea mug here that the city has put that, you know, an electric coal plant on, you know, their mug here. It's sort of an iconic building. So in this project, Unearthing Providence, that Professor Frickle has, is sort of trying to unearth that past so that people can see sort of that layer of industrial activity affecting the soil and water around us and how that could contribute as historical land use. So in this particular project, you know, looking at publicly available data sets that could contribute to looking at toxic transfer to green infrastructure, there are data sets that each community engagement core was using for their own projects and had developed this novel research question that would sort of, again, sort of that data reuse, but it's also data repurposing. So that these are data sets that might already exist, but how can they be made interoperable so that they can be applied to a new research question? And so these are just sort of a listing of those data sets. And I'd like to, you know, again, call out Dr. Staslavsky at UCSD for developing this system data discovery studio that, if you haven't checked it out, the URL I have at the top, that allowed us to take sort of those schema.org data sets, those geo databases, and some of this other publicly available data, and then pull it in that could then discover it in these repositories and then bring it into a space that could then enhance the metadata for interoperability. And so he's a great person to reach out to talk about the synergy ontology that sort of helps to scan text of abstracts and whatnot, and then assign or map onto CHEBI terms, for example. How do you automate enhancement of metadata? And then Matthew at Texas ANU then can sort of take those data sets from those spaces and then create an ArcGIS dashboard, as these different algorithms of risk are developed, where, you know, certain data sets are given a certain weight, they can then sort of identify areas that, might be worthy of looking into, you know, what are the risks and what are the mitigation of those risks that environmental scientists would want to know. The health is at risk, or in this case, green infrastructure. And in the slides, there's a link where you can get to that interactive online dashboard. So this is one sort of data visualization platform that's accessible to many people. You know, ArcGIS is sort of familiar. And then there's, as I mentioned, some of these FAIR enhancements that were done through this project, like looking at GIS specific metadata like ISO 19115 or 19139, and then looking at some of the tools that beyond the ArcGIS, there's a separate system called SWAV that Dr. Staslavsky is also involved with, where it's a data analysis platform and visualization platform. So in addition to sort of the dashboard, this is sort of a space in which you could sort of work with that data and integrates with interactive notebooks, in this case, like a Jupyter notebook. And folks could then apply the same principle to other research questions. And so I'm just going to skip ahead to have that link there and then also see how that's being applied. So in here, looking at land cover for each of the three counties, but then seeing how that's applied, okay, that we were talking about green infrastructure, and now Professor Pizzoli and he are looking at how can this now be used for other types of risks. So for example, here it's in COVID and their response in San Diego, they were involved with community gardens. So they're, you know, the sort of the sky's the limit once that those data sets are available. So I'm going to, because I know I've done a lot of talking, so I want to highlight, so these are some of the lessons and recommendations. So I think that with the reuse, you know, just focusing on the historical industrial data, one of the things that when I mentioned that reuse and replication is hard, was that in the original data set that was created for Providence County, for example, the images were scanned by professional archivists by an organization that is professional scanning. So they were very high quality images. And so the original software that was used to extract and geocode that data set, you know, to output the location of these industries, but then also map them to an industrial code so that you can say, okay, these were the types of activities going on in these spaces. You know, that was great in that sort of pristine environment. But what was really interesting to Professor Frickel was that, you know, once we went out sort of outside of that sort of pristine environment to, you know, in the case of San Diego, the images that were located, you know, they might have been scanned at a lower DPI, for example, or the formatting on the page might have been such that the software had to, you know, there was a lot of work to go back and work with that algorithm so that it could work with images. So that was, you know, I think exemplary of what we mean by data reuse can be hard. And even though there's a great protocol that's out there, there's software, you know, it's just, you know, there is some work, and sometimes that work might be data cleaning. So a lot of effort that goes into cleaning data. It might be the systems like UCSD have developed to sort of enhance the metadata of those objects. And then there's the one where, you know, once you have all the pieces, you know, you have the documentation, you have the data set, you have the software, it can still be a challenge. And I think that's a great sort of takeaway lesson from this project. And these are some of the outputs and products that some of the PRs are working on. So again, I'm not an environmental scientist, so I'm sure if you have lots of questions about the science itself, to reach out to these folks here.
Andrew, thank you very much. And I am guessing that is your last slide. I kind of just jumped in here. Am I okay? Okay, thank you for sharing those lessons learned and those tools that I encourage everyone to go check out. We have a couple minutes here. I think I'm going to get to some of these comments and questions that we have. So first of all, just letting you know, you had a comment from earlier in your talk that it is agreed that failures need to be documented and publicized just as much as the successes. So all of this work that you're doing is very important. I want to move to a question here about if you're on a project team, how would you go about collaborating and adding a research informationist to a research team or project?
Yeah, I think, you know, as I tried to highlight with academic libraries, you know, there might be a discipline-based librarian, you know, a science librarian that knows some of these sort of FAIR principles and practice that they could collaborate with, but also the public library sphere, because I realize that not everyone's at a university and some folks might be at sort of a state agency. And with the partnership with Kate Wells, for example, at the Providence Public Library, you know, we have these archivists who also have this knowledge sort of spread out. So I think that's, you know, one is just sort of introducing yourself and the project that you have. But then there's also, you know, the PIs, like I mentioned, who have been open and seeing the value of having librarians as part of the research team. And then also, again, crediting NIH for those really generous incentives. So I think going back to 2012, where, you know, research informationist wasn't really a known entity or role, and then sort of by providing those administrative supplements to fund having, you know, sort of an incentive to add a library personnel to a project team, and then hopefully that from there, if so many folks had successes that they could then say, oh, we'd love to invite them as our data management analysis core collaborator or a community engagement core collaborator. And that's what I think Dr. Pozzoli had seen when we saw the last, you know, when we saw the EDC presentations about how many informationists were there on those teams. And it was a great thing to see. And I really appreciate him sort of suggesting this talk so that we, you know, to make that work and labor visible.
Great. And I do want to quickly get to one more question. So if you could answer, please, I think this is a useful question. What steps can researchers take to better the chances or successes of data reuse? If you could give us two or three tips here for better chances of data reuse.
Sure. I think that, you know, the focus on, you know, this is something that my colleague Vicky Steves, who developed ReproZip at NYU, that I've seen her say a lot, which is not focusing just on the data, that reproducibility, people think, I share the data, that's going to be the magic answer, where it's really that, you know, if I go back to those earlier slides, you know, we worked on the protocol, revising the protocol, software development, and the data set itself. And so you sort of have to need all of these pieces, and not just sort of, I know that data sharing is sort of, people sort of zero in on the data piece, but without all of those other components, it might not necessarily be so reusable. And I'm thinking of an organismal biologist at Harvard who had visited Brown on our, we have sort of open access, like a week, open access week, and she was a guest speaker, and she had talked about, you know, 9 times out of 10, she might download a data set from a repository, but it's actually really unusable because it doesn't have all of that context that Dartmouth talked about that would make it able to actually be reused.
Awesome. Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you very much. There's a few more questions, comments, and stuff that have come in, but I think we are going to have to move on to the next speaker. So thank you very much, Andrew. So if we can transition to the third speaker, David, if you could try to get your slides up, and I see your camera, I see you are unmuted, and I see your title slide. So I am happy to introduce Dr. David Tarbutton. He directs the Utah Water Research Laboratory at Utah State University, which conducts research to generate the knowledge needed to solve water-related problems in Utah and around the world. He is going to introduce HydraShare, a repository developed for sharing data and models within the hydrology and water resources community served by Kuwazi. David, I turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to present. So I'll be telling you about Kuwazi HydraShare. Kuwazi stands for Consortium of Universities for the Advancement of Hydrologic Science Incorporated. It's about 100 or more universities funded by the National Science Foundation to come together to do collaborative big science. And HydraShare is its data sharing cyber infrastructure system. It's a web-based community platform for sharing data as well as models, developed by a fairly large team, some but not all of the names are listed here, supported by the National Science Foundation. I know you can get the slides from the EPA website, but you could also go to HydraShare yourself if you want to experience it, and search for NIEHS 2020 and find them. So this work is motivated by grand challenges in hydrology and water resources, such as flooding, droughts, water quality, where we think that advancing understanding and generating knowledge depends on collaboration and data sharing. I put in water research, but that applies to many domains as well. And I think that one of the themes of what I'll be presenting is that hopefully the ideas that we've developed here have a generality and crossover to other domains. But that requires open data, integration of information from multiple sources. So no longer can one investigator measure all the information they need to make breakthroughs, and it also requires easy to use, generally accessible, shareable computing and working as a team and community. So think of water research as a team sport. We also face difficulties in reproducing our research. And this slide refers to a paper by Jim Steggy, David Rosenberg et al., published in 2019, looking at reproducibility of some water resources or water research studies. They looked at 360 papers. 107 didn't have the data supporting their research accessible. Of the rest, 78 didn't have the data online. 155, the data that was online was incomplete. And then there were various other problems. But at the end of the day, they only found 4 that they could fully reproduce the calculations that were reported in the paper. And that's a challenge. It's been reported in other scientific domains as well. There've been Nature papers about it. But to establish trust in the findings from our research, it's really important that we have transparency and reproducibility. And this is a lot of the impetus behind findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable, and the whole data sharing impetus. So the take-home message from this presentation is that fulfilling the open data mandate, achieving fair data, and reproducible, trustworthy scientific research requires information, data, and model sharing systems that help people, help scientists avoid falling into the sort of 98% of papers that are not reproducible. So we think that that requires data management through the full data life cycle. So not only sharing your data at the end of the project, but getting your data into a repository and into a well-organized system at the beginning when it's being prepared, describing the data, publishing it, making sure you've got discoverability and capability for analysis, and then repeating the cycle. So HydroShares, our efforts to achieve this for the hydrology and water resources research community. And I would ask you to consider using it if your data is water related, and consider the ideas and approaches developed for other domain areas. So HydroShare is first and foremost a platform for sharing hydrologic resources and for collaborating. So it starts off with file storage. You can think of this as being Dropbox-ish like functionality. But in addition to the data files, you need other things. You need metadata descriptions. You need machine readability, perhaps through an applications programming interface. You need web apps that can work with the data. You may want to collaborate around the data with social functions and eventually publish it. So there's value-added functionality that gets to the goal of HydroShare being to advance the science by enabling the community to more easily and freely share the products from the research, not only the publication, but the data and the models. And we're grouping in models, and that's why you'll see us me using the term resources for the information that that HydroShare holds. So this is a bit of an illustration of a use case. A user may create a data set and upload it to HydroShare, then make it accessible initially in a limited way to a research team. That team iterates collaboratively. Each person may be adding something to the analysis, adding a part of metadata, describing it as they're going along when the information is fresh in their mind. Then a final version is published and assigned a digital object identifier, and the user cites the data set in a paper. So these are the founding principles or ideas that we've tried to hold to in working with HydroShare. That data and models are the first class product of research. Where's the laser pointer here? Are the first class products of research and should be shared. They become social objects. So just like you think of Facebook, perhaps the social object is photos and pictures. YouTube, the social object is videos. In HydroShare, it's water resources data. They are stored in resources that become shareable. Research data management should start at the beginning of the project, and resources should be systematically managed throughout the full life cycle. So this shows some of the objects, data types, if you will, that we have to deal with in hydrology. Time series data, geospatial data, perhaps in a geographic feature class or a shapefile, gridded data, maybe multidimensional data, and maybe even the model and the workflow. So some of the components that have been built into HydroShare, I'm going to describe here. This is effectively the sort of architecture schematic in a simplified way. HydroShare is first and foremost a website built using Django, which is a web framework that we used. That website is where users would interact with it for resource exploration, discover the content, organize and annotate the information. That's where you can go to find groups for collaboration, where you control who has access. So it's got manager access. And if you, there's a little bit of an analogy to a PC here, and this, you can think of this as the file browser in a PC. At the bottom, we have resource storage in IRODS, the Integrated Rule-Oriented Data System, which supports storage across multiple locations. So it's distributed file storage. And we've got the resources within HydroShare have a resource data model that I'll talk more about later that has content type aggregations for chosen data types that are fairly general. Then on the right, we have HydroShare apps. And if you take the PC analogy a step further, you could think of these as the programs that are on your PC, and the resource storage would be the different hard disks on your PC. So just as you can get programs from anywhere, web apps are not necessarily resident in the HydroShare system, but it's software that can act through application programming interfaces to work on data in the system. So that allows effectively anybody to set up a server or an app platform, which provides for extensibility. And there's a number of examples. The most used are JupyterHub platforms that perform sort of Python and Jupyter Notebook type computations on data retrieved from HydroShare and then let you put it back into HydroShare. But there's also a MATLAB online application for that. There's a Unidata thread server for multidimensional data, and also a very specific hydrologic model, SWAT, that has a SWAT share application. So this is moving us towards a sort of a fully web-based innovation environment. So focusing in on the website, the data repository, that's where you manage your data. And here I was actually going to break away from the presentation and do show to you for real. So this is the HydroShare website. If you go into it, you'll see it describes how it works. You can create data, upload data to HydroShare, describe it with metadata, share it with colleagues, permanently publish, and there's more information down there. You can email Kwazi for support. You can go to GitHub to see the code. You can, within HydroShare, so there I clicked on home, open a specific resource. And here I'm going to go to one of the ones that I had on the slide. This happens to be LiDAR data from an experimental forest. And this is the sort of metadata that HydroShare has. This is a published resource, so it's been assigned a digital object identifier. There's an abstract that was written by the researchers. It's got spatial coverage information. So the previous speaker was talking about some of that. There's geographic projection information. It's WGS 84, so it's precisely defined which it is. Then you can go and see the content file. So there's a number of zip files, and there's a PDF document that gives a bit of description. There's credit information saying where this work was funded, people who've contributed to it, how to cite information, and a license. So these are some of the things that we encourage putting on HydroShare resources. I'm going to now show how it might work in conjunction with publication. So this happens to be a water resources paper that I published with a graduate student two years ago now. And it describes some work on flood inundation mapping. And in the paper, we have at the end a statement that says, in an effort to make the study reproducible, the data and computational scripts have been saved in HydroShare, and there's a link to a citation. So if we go to the references of the paper, there you see that's the citation. It says HydroShare. It's got a digital object identifier. And if you click on that, it will now open up that corresponding resource in HydroShare. There it is. And it describes, this is the data for that paper. The resource contains this data. There's the abstract from the paper. There's subject keywords if people are doing discovery for this. There's again, spatial information, spatial coverage information. So this shows that where the study location was. There's a number of folders which include some of the data as well as some of the scripts for the work to be completely reproduced. And then lower down, there's so here some of this data is geospatial information, grids, geographic grids, and geographic features. So HydroShare automatically sets up web map services and web feature services for that data to be specifically machine readable. There's a resource pointing back to the Water Resources Research paper citation, and again credit for the funding. So this is the sort of thing that we're encouraging. And some of the things like the web map service and geospatial coverage, those happen as immediately a user adds a file of a recognized format, in this case, either a GIS shapefile or GIS GeoTIFF file. Metadata can be read from that and spatial coverage information extracted and projected onto the coordinate system we're using for our resource level coverage. If you load multidimensional data in a NetCDF file with CF conventions metadata, that metadata can again also get extracted and even populate things like the abstract and title, if that's in the file that you've got. So it's trying to help users make it easy. If that information is not there, then the user still has to add that information. So let's see if I can get back to the slides. Those were some of the points that I tried to make, showing that. And there's the research article, and there's the example of the from the system. So I mentioned the resource data model. This is using a library standard. So I don't know whether the previous speakers sort of familiar with this, but I think certain resources in the Library of Congress use it, but Open Archives Initiative Object Reuse and Exchange Standard. So we've developed our model using these standards, and there's two levels of information. The resource can hold multiple content aggregations, managed as a discoverable resource with unique identifier, resource level metadata, access controls. So you can share work initially privately for the early collaboration, then it becomes permanently published. Then within the resource, there might be a multidimensional aggregation or a geographic feature aggregation that can hold files that comprise a single logical object of a different data type, and they have their own specific metadata. We're also using schema.org that supports findability from, for example, Google Dataset Search and Dublin Core metadata. So the next major part of it is a gateway to computing. So one of the things that we found, while it's certainly important to have a repository where people can publish their data, they ask, what's in it for me? Why should I do it now? And maybe put it off till they absolutely have to. by linking HydroShare with compute platforms, you can provide immediate value to a researcher. Plus, you can also simplify things. So the linkage to a web-based gateway for computing on a HydroShare resource, there's a button at the top, open with, and you can open it with, say, Quasi JupyterHub or a GIS application or MATLAB Online or OpenDAP, which is the Threads service. Then it will effectively copy that content into that web app and do whatever that web app does, which may be model input data preparation, model execution, visualization that somebody else might have set up for you. So this reduces the need for software installation. You get a degree of platform independence out of this. It's really useful for teaching where some students have PCs, others have Macs, and you don't have to worry about the specific configurations or lack of capacity that they may have on their computer. You can write and execute code in a Jupyter notebook, acting on contents of HydroShare resources, saving the results back, thereby collaborating. And if you've got access to high-performance computing, you can work with big data sets. And through the procedures being available, you've increased transparency, replicability, and reproducibility. So this just steps you through a little bit of the JupyterHub application. You might open a resource with the open with button. Then there's a little fetch utility that retrieves the contents into JupyterHub that we established working with the Science Gateways Community Institute. Then you end up in the JupyterHub platform that you can open the Jupyter notebook. And inside the Jupyter notebook, you step through whatever the scripts are that that notebook developer, which can be anybody in the community, has set up. And at the end, you can save your results back into HydroShare for long-term preservation. So interoperability is an important concept. And there was some interoperability in the sort of previous example with the web map services as well as the Jupyter notebooks. This is a slide that was from a NSF program director, the program that initially funded HydroShare, that talked about the NSF vision for software ecosystems where they all sort of interoperate. Machine-to-machine connections, many interfaces to shared software. So this is an important foundation of the web, recognizing that no one system can do it all. Therefore, we need application programming interfaces that systems can speak to each other. That requires unique identifiers so that that communication becomes unambiguous. There would be, ultimately, you get a sort of a cyber infrastructure ecosystem of many interfaces to shared services, and you end up developing a personal set of tools, a personal cyber infrastructure that you're familiar with that you can use to accomplish any research task that's not done by one system. So this is one of the interoperability examples with HydroShare through GeoServer and the web map services that I showed you. But once you've got data that's geographic in HydroShare, these web map services get established as soon as you make the data public, and that's because they don't have an access control mechanism to them, you can do things like visualize them in ArcGIS.com, the system developed by Esri for web mapping. So rather than trying to do our own web mapping, you can take advantage of what a big software company is doing. So this gets into some of the groups that are using HydroShare. So one of the communities is the Critical Zone Collaborative Network. And here, this is a project that Quasi is coordinating the data management for the Critical Zone Collaborative Network. And HydroShare is just one of the repositories being used. There's other ones here, EarthChem, Open Topography, a data submission portal being set up, compute resources being set up. and then a catalog for discovery, relying on things like schema.org to support discovery. So Urban Flooding Open Knowledge Network is a National Science Foundation Convergence Accelerator project. And this team is also relying on HydroShare. They're looking to deliver flood information to anyone, anytime, anywhere, a holistic approach to better understand how floods impact the urban multiplex. So it's power grids. A flood may take out a power station. It may impact sewage. Obviously, there's perhaps public health involved. Locks and dams, various protection infrastructure. So a potential user, emergency Erica, may want to ask a simple query, what areas of my city are at risk? And there's artificial intelligence, knowledge graph technology to deliver those results. And HydroShare is supporting this supporting some of the data integration parts of it. So some of the spatial and temporal data coming out of models can get fed through, as well as community contributed research products. So with respect to reproducibility, I showed the sort of limitations from the study right at the beginning. In terms of thinking about it, this is an EarthCube project that I'm part of, that's looking at the different levels of reproducibility. Maybe you can repeat the work on a similar machine or run it on a different computer, or you can reproduce the results with the same data or get the same findings with new data, and working out what are the things that you need for that to be achieved. You need a repository. You also need APIs to perhaps work with models. Maybe you need containerized computational environments so that the libraries that were actually used in the original research can be reused to get the same results. So I've got a little bit here at the end about who's using HydroShare. So we first went online in the middle of 2015, and by now we're up to approaching 10,000 user accounts. The primary audience is the hydrologic research community, but it's really open to anyone, water resource professionals, educators, citizen scientists.
Excuse me, David, sorry to interrupt, but just in the interest of making sure we could discuss your presentation a little bit, if you could wrap up in a minute or so.
Okay, sure. So there are slides here on the audience, different organizations, the growth and resources. So lessons learned, having a community is critical. So being associated with Quasi is good, providing immediate value, building on standards, being interoperable, partnering to expand the funding base. There's a summary slide, but I think I've hit many of those points. And this has really been a team effort, so I appreciate all the work of the team. And there's links there that you could follow to learn more. And we're also looking for developers. So if you're interested, you can email. And I will stop there. Sorry if I went long.
David, thank you very much for the presentation and all of those links and papers to follow. I'm going to remind people that they can enter questions in the Q&A box. I do see a hand that's been up for a little bit here, and I just want to make sure. So Tanobla Badu, I see a hand up. Would you like to ask a question? I think you have the ability to unmute yourself now. I'm not sure. Yep, there you go. It's red and muted again. I saw it white for a second there. Are you able to get to the Q&A box? I'm wondering. Okay, it is unmuted now. Are you speaking? Unfortunately, I'm not hearing anything come through. I hope there is another way you can communicate with us, maybe through the Q&A box, but please keep trying, and if we hear you, we will let you ask your question. All right, let's stand by to see if we hear from this attendee. But David, while we're here, maybe just a little bit of discussion about what you have presented here. Some people may be interested. Are there size limitations to what you can put into HydraShare?
There are, as with everything. There's two limitations. The first is the total amount of space that is available to any user, and that's currently set at 20 gigabytes. But that's a soft limit because we wanted to make sure that things don't get out of control. And if you're a funded researcher from the Hydrologic Sciences Program at NSF, which is funding HydraShare, and you can go with a request to Kwazi that says you need more space, then your quota can certainly be increased. We also have one of the things with that size limit is we also want to establish a relationship with people who may need to exceed that capacity to see if we can figure out an appropriate payment, to figure out some funding. Because if a large organization, maybe a consulting company, wanted to start using it, then we would have to sort of negotiate. But they would use the initial quota to work it out. The other limit is through the web interface, 1 gigabyte is the largest file size that sort of physically works with the technology we're using. We're working on improving that, and there are ways to get larger files into the system going directly through iRODS. But we advise against too large files because they become unwieldy for people to actually download them. We have one resource that's got a 100 gigabyte file, and it's really great that that person has put that information in, but if you start trying to download it, it takes forever, and then what you're going to do with it when you got it?
Okay, thank you, David. So, you know, sometimes I try to just cram in as many questions as possible, but I'm going to try to resist that this time. I would just like to say there has been a question in the Q&A for our speakers to think about. I'm hoping there's a way for this to be thought about. It might require some more thought, but a way to communicate this back to the audience later, maybe on that website. This interesting question, are there prospects for having these data collaborative efforts extended globally around the world? And thinking of the three different talks that we heard today, you know, what makes sense and what could be done or what would be next steps. But I am looking at the clock and I am on the time where I'm supposed to start wrapping up here. So I just want to say, David, all other speakers, thank you so much for your presentations. And we're going to move into the concluding slides. All right, as we get those slides up, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. There it is, the URL right there. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to the feedback form. We ask that you please consider filling out the online feedback form. We look at the comments and continue to try to improve the content delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Okay, so feedback form, confirmation email if you want a record of your participation. So please stay connected. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any future webinars. For more information on EPA's ClueIn webinars, please refer to the ClueIn.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter Tech Direct and follow ClueIn on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risk e-learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. So there are upcoming sessions. I'd like to encourage everyone to join us on June 18th for the final session in the series. This session will feature SRP-funded researchers collaborating to combine omics, such as genomics and proteomics, data within and across model organisms, as well as studies in human populations. We will also hear from the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health about their work to incorporate semantic data models for sharing of genomic data to align with environmental health research. If you'd like to join the webinars, registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you cannot attend, archives will be made available after the event, so you can come back to these pages for links to the archives after the webinars are held. And with that, it is time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we'll pass those questions along to the presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. The email addresses are on the seminar homepage on ClueIn. So I would like to thank our presenters, Pianpian, Caradwen, Andrew, and David, for their time preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.